Hello, hello. This is Harry, and welcome to another episode of A2Easy. I have Dan here with me.
Hello there. So what's the topic for today?
Today it's SVT.
Well, you have just done the typical medic behaviour of using an acronym without explaining it. So please, could you tell me what is an SVT?
A supraventricular tachycardia, which is a collective term for a large group of abnormal heart rhythms. So it's when the heart is beating fast, a tachycardia is technically above 100 BPM, but in SVT, we classically see rates above 150. The supraventricular part is as non-specific as it sounds. It's a catch-all term for any fast heart rate that is caused by a depolarization that doesn't initiate in the ventricles. Any idea why that last part's particularly important?
Well, I guess because ventricular tachycardia, or VT or VTAC, as it's called on American TV shows, is a rhythm that you encounter in a crash call. So specifically, pulseless VT is one of the four key rhythms encountered in a cardiac arrest and is considered a shockable rhythm.
Absolutely. So VT in general is bad. Pulseless VT is very bad. And fortunately for us, SVT is an umbrella term for all the other kinds of tachycardia. Alongside where the tachycardia is originated from the heart, you can also think about them in terms of speed of onset. When medics talk about SVT, we generally mean a tachycardia which is abrupt in onset. It's just worth knowing that there are much slower onset tachycardias which wax and wane over a longer period of time. These still technically fall within the umbrella SVT, but they are a different kettle of fish, so to speak, and have a different approach to management. Similarly, people can become tachycardic for a variety of reasons, okay, such as an underlying PE or as a feature of sepsis. Here, the patient would typically have a sinus tachycardia. That's where the beat is initiated from the pacemaker, the sinoatrial node. The tachycardia itself in these examples would also technically fit under the umbrella term of SVT because the SAN is above the ventricles. But really, the tachycardia is a sign of a separate underlying condition, and it's more precisely described as a sinus tachycardia, so we don't call these SVTs in clinical practice.
Okay, so for the purpose of this episode, we're going to focus on what people generally mean by an SVT, which is an abrupt onset paroxysmal tachycardia emerging from above the ventricles, which has not been triggered by another condition.
Correct. It's an important point to make clear that SVT is a very broad term, which we often use in practice to mean a really specific group of conditions which involved an abnormal conduction pathway in the heart, for example. Now, we usually wouldn't talk about investigations till later in the episode, but in order to identify an SVT, you really need an ECG. So, I think we should cover this first. I will attach one example of an SVT in the episode description so you can see for yourselves and follow along if you'd like, maybe to spot some of the features that I'm hopefully trying to describe. So, after you confirm the patient details, you've checked the time of the ECG, the calibration is 25mm and all that lovely stuff that you've been taught to do in your OSCE, you can look at the rate of the ECG. There will be a tachycardia present, obviously, and then the QRS complex will be narrow, i.e. three small squares or less, which is 120 milliseconds, if that's how you'd prefer to think about it. Narrow QRS complexes mean the initial depolarization, which triggers the heart to beat, originates from above the ventricles. If it was ventricular, it would be a wide QRS. So, question, Dan, please could you describe the conduction pathway of the heart briefly?
Sure, so normally any given heartbeat starts with the sinoatrial node in the upper right atrium. The wave of depolarization moves to the atrioventricular node at the base of the right atrium, and then to the bundle of His, which is at the top of the intraventricular septum, and this then splits into the left and right bundle branches, which then become Purkinje fibers further down.
Yep, very good knowledge. Look at you. Fantastic medical student. The reason I ask is because the cause of supraventricular tachycardia has to be above the ventricles, as the name suggests. So in terms of that pathway, the conduction has to start from the bundle of His or above.
Okay, so that makes sense. So it would be a narrow complex tachycardia which would have a source from the bundle of His or above. Are there any other features of SVT?
Well, the key thing is the pulse is often so fast that the QRS complexes get very close to each other and the rhythm often just looks like a bunch of QRS complexes with T waves. It's possible P waves are actually occurring, but they are often masked by the preceding T waves, which is important. Why?
Well, I suppose because the true presence or absence of a P wave would help you identify the origin of a supraventricular tachycardia. So, for example, one of the only differentiators between an atrial tachycardia and a junctional tachycardia would be the presence of P waves.
Yeah, exactly. Two very complicated terms that we're going to helpfully leave to the side. So SVT is an umbrella term rather than a specific underlying diagnosis. That's the key thing to get across. And it's going to give us a fast general pattern.
Okay, so we know an SVT describes a general pattern demonstrated on ECG, but in a non-exam world where patients don't have an ECG ready to go, what kind of signs and symptoms might a person with an SVT display?
Well, given their heart is working considerably harder than normal, patients generally are aware of this and report palpitations. In general, when someone says they have palpitations, it's important to identify whether they think the rhythm is regular or irregular. Sometimes it can be helpful to ask them to tap it out with their hands, as a method that I actually try a lot in clinical practice. The problem with the heart beating that fast is there is a reduced diastolic filling time. So, less blood can enter the heart before each beat, and the stroke volume is effectively reduced.
Okay, and we all remember that heart rate times stroke volume equals cardiac output. So, even though the heart rate is rapid, the reduced stroke volume would mean that your cardiac output could be either normal or low.
I like you think we all remember. So patients can present with just palpitations, for example, but their cardiac output can drop, which is serious because the other equation everyone will also definitely remember, blood pressure equals cardiac output times systemic vascular resistance. So the drop in cardiac output precipitates a drop in their blood pressure, which can cause a collapse, which is bad.
So there's clearly a range of presentations from isolated palpitations, for example, all the way to a full bone episode of collapse. Are there any other specific symptoms to be aware of?
Well, I suppose patients can also develop lightheadedness, dyspnea, chest discomfort, and clamminess. But ultimately, patients having an SVT often clearly express that they do not feel well. And so, for example, anxiety is often used as colloquially as a term as one of their symptoms.
Okay, so palpitations, a clear sense of feeling unwell, sweating, chest discomfort, dyspnea, and even collapse. You mentioned these come as episodes. How long might we expect them to last?
Well, an SVT can just last seconds. However, when seen in a medical setting, they typically have lasted a lot longer than that. With that in mind, a quirky bit of physiology that patients can report, weirdly, is polyuria. So if the episode has lasted a long enough time, it's thought to be because of the release of atrial natriuretic peptide from atrial stretch, which causes diuresis.
Okay, that's interesting. Although, perhaps not something to remember diagnostically, I suppose.
Yeah.
Are there any particular triggers for an episode of SVT?
Well, alcohol is a classic precipitant, and that's worth remembering. People often also mention caffeine here, but actually there isn't much evidence to suggest caffeine precipitates SVT episodes. Instead, it can cause a slight pressor effect, which means a relatively faster heart rate or a higher blood pressure, but it's not actually proarrhythmic. Also, of note, lots of drugs can cause a sinus tachycardia, which can look a lot like SVT when the rate is fast enough.
And who actually gets SVTs?
Well, it's common and it's often self-terminating as a condition. Women are twice as likely as men to develop an SVT, and it's more common in older populations. The reason it tends to be more common in older populations is because things like cardiovascular disease increase your risk.
So alcohol can trigger an episode and cardiovascular disease increases your risk. What about the underlying pathology here?
Well, there are many potential underlying causes and you really can go down the rabbit hole with this kind of thing. So I suggest we try and keep it simple. The common and the critically important. So let's firstly consider an important differential. When the heart is beating this fast, it becomes much harder to tell whether the beat is actually regular or not. If the underlying beat is irregular, fast AF is the common cause. A very closely associated condition is atrial flutter. So whilst AF is described as being irregularly irregular on ECGs, atrial flutter is usually a regular rhythm, where the atria contract in a rapid, organised fashion, but don't conduct every single beat to the ventricles. So you get a pattern of a few atrial beats which look like sortie from the ECG, and then a normal conducted beat. It has what's termed a conduction ratio, which can be regular or irregular. As with sinus tachycardia, we don't often call Barndorf, fast AF, or atrial flutter examples of SVT, because they are better described as their own separate entities. Instead, when we talk about SVT, we are alluding to intermittent bouts of usually abrupt onset, regular, rapid tachycardia. So these, instead, often involve the presence of a physiological or anatomically abnormal conduction pathway. This creates a circuit which can loop back around rather than a circuit which can terminate like normal. Another word for this kind of looping is re-entry, because the depolarization, instead of terminating, will re-enter the conduction pathway and go around again and again and again. We label these circuits differently based on where they are anatomically within the heart. So you might hear labels such as AVRT and AVNRT. Atrioventricular nodal reentrant tachycardia is hard to say, and it does sound complicated, but if we break it down, it just means an abnormal conduction pathway which causes a looped circuit with subsequent tachycardia, and it originates from around the AV node.
But why would this looping circuit cause a tachycardia rather than just a normal rate?
Good question. For this next section, I just want to preface it by saying that this is fundamental cardiac electrophysiology, which is good for understanding of first principles, but doesn't necessarily convert into an easy-to-write multiple-choice question, so just bear that in mind. The looping circuit causes a tachycardia because it overrides the physiological rate regulation which you get from the SAN. The SAN effectively can't get a word in edgeways, is what I'm trying to say.
So the reentrant circuit circumvents the regulation because the cardiac depolarization loops around again rather than beginning in the sinoatrial node each time.
Exactly, so that the SAN just gets circumvented. They're a bit of like a host unto themselves, really, which is why you can get really high heart rates. You don't usually get crazy high heart rates like 300 beats per minute, though, because the AVN is still involved, and that has a slight braking effect.
So we know they are looping circuits, but what's the difference between AVRT and AVNRT loops?
Okay, so to answer that, we need to remember that cardiac depolarizations are a wave of electrical charge. Point one. The other thing to remember is that in the wake of cardiac depolarizations, tissue needs time to recover, aka the refractory period. This is the reset time, where the tissue can't be stimulated. With all that in mind, let's talk about AVNRT first. AVNRT is a problem around the AVN. The AVN is more complicated than a single patch of tissue, which is what I was led to believe. So these patches of tissue communicate via pathways. The problem arises when one pathway is slow and one is fast. A metaphor explaining this is that the slow pathway is like a cat and the fast pathway is like a dog. And the conduction down the circuit is you trying to give each one a bath. Please bear with me. The cat hates water, so it really doesn't want to have a bath, and it's fidgety, and meaning it takes ages for that to actually happen in the first place. It then dries itself off really quickly because it hates the water. The dog actually likes a bit of a paddle.
There is a doggy paddle pun in here somewhere.
Shut up. So the doggy paddles, has a quick bath, and because it doesn't hate the water, it doesn't dry off as fast as the cat does. It has a longer refractory period. So think of it like the slow pathway actively doesn't like being stimulated, so it's slow to conduct and has a shorter refractory period. And that's because it hates being stimulated so much.
Okay, that's enough with the pet washing. How does this relate to AVNRT exactly?
So in normal physiology, you have these two pathways which work at the same speed, so they just happily conduct in sync with each other. There's no issue. In AVNRT, the difference in conduction speed and refractory periods mean they can get out of sync with each other. When that can happen, typically, is when the fast pathway will conduct down first and loop into the slow pathway, going back up, meeting the slow depolarization during its journey and cancelling it out. The slow pathway then has a shorter refractory period, because they are like cats hating water, they dry off quicker. Which means when the next normal conduction happens, it can go down the ready-to-go slow pathway. But the fast one is still in its refractory period. That then gives the slow pathway plenty of time to go down and loop back up again the recovering fast pathway and round again and again and again and again.
So AVNRT is AV nodal reentrant tachycardia, where there are abnormal slow and fast tracks which go to the AVN. And they get out of sync, and eventually, because of the shorter refractory period, the slow pathway is able to conduct up retrograde and then form a looping circuit.
Correct. And you can remember the cats and dogs metaphor if you like to describe the conduction speed and refractory period of each pathway if you get stuck.
So if it's now looping around and around, how can it just self-terminate?
Well, because of the AVN and its braking effect that disrupts the circuit. When the pathways loop, they have to go past the AVN, which can, if you are lucky, slow the depolarization just enough to give the SAN a chance to transmit a cardiac depolarization down. When the pathway has extra time to recover from its refractory period and meet the looping depolarization head-on, that cancels both out again and resets the entire circuit.
So the braking effect of the AVN can cause it to spontaneously reset itself.
Correct. Which is why these abrupt onset SVTs also abruptly end, and why we describe them as paroxysmal.
So is that the same then for AVRT?
Yes, because the loop circuit AVRT also involves the AVN. So the AVN can influence it too.
Can you describe what the circuit is in AVRT then, ideally without mentioning any more animals?
All right. Look, okay, so this one's hopefully simpler to explain.
I will be the judge of that.
Okay, so bear with me. Instead of a pathway working badly, we instead have an extra new pathway altogether called an accessory pathway.
And does this pathway have a name?
I guess the name depends on the exact type of AVRT. But fortunately, there is really only one AVRT you will see in medical school exams. And it has an eponymous name. Dan?
Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome.
Exactly, yeah. So Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome is a relatively common disorder of the heart, which involves an accessory pathway. In Wolff-Parkinson-White, the pathway is called the bundle of Kent. Yay, Kent. It connects the atria to the ventricles, but circumventing the AV node. The looping circuit can be triggered by the cardiac depolarization moving down normally into the ventricle, and then, instead of just ending there, moving back up the accessory pathway into the atria. That cardiac depolarization then triggers another contraction without the involvement of the sinoatrial node, causing a self-propagating loop between the atria and the ventricles. Atrioventricular reentrant tachycardia.
Okay, that does sound a little bit simpler.
Right, so Wolff-Parkinson-White is a type of AVRT, but it's sometimes regarded as a serious condition because it's also a potential cause of sudden cardiac death. When the patient is not having an SVT episode, their ECG will have a subtle abnormality which can come up in an OSCE station or a multiple choice question. Dan, could you please describe the abnormality?
Yes, I know this one. So it's called a delta wave. It's an abnormality of the QRS complex where you lose the crisp, sudden upwards or downwards deflection in the initial Q wave. And it's often called a slurring of the upstroke.
Absolutely right. There's lots of weird phrases we use for it. And what you're really noticing there is pre-excitation of the ventricles. Because now, some of the cardiac depolarization doesn't have to wait for the break at the AVM, which normally happens. Some of it can just go straight down the accessory pathway and get activated early, rather than all at the same time. The ECG finding is technically just called Wolff-Parkinson-White pattern. The person might never actually get SVT symptoms, but if they do, that then becomes Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome.
So do medical schools like to include this on exams just because it requires you to really look at an ECG properly to notice it? Or?
Well, there is probably an element of that, to be honest. But like I said, it's a potentially life-threatening problem, which can, thankfully, be treated.
So why would Wolff-Parkinson-White pattern cause sudden cardiac death?
In short, arrhythmias are bad. Because the accessory pathway which shows up as pre-excitation, it can bypass the protective filtering effects of the AVN, as we've just said. That's important in AF. As we know, AF is where the fibrillating means that there are lots of little contractions in the atria, which in this case can conduct down the accessory pathway. Normally, these are filtered out by the AV node. But if a person with Wolff-Parkinson-White pattern happens to go into AF, you can get a really high heart rate which conducts down that accessory pathway. I'm talking 300 beats per minute. That behaves like ventricular fibrillation, which is a cardiac arrest rhythm.
So arrhythmias are indeed bad. Fortunately, you said this is treatable, but that just reminds me, so we're still out of sequence and haven't really mentioned any investigations for SVT besides an ECG. So do you want to quickly just say, is there anything else we need to know?
Oh, yeah, you're right. So we will come back to Wolff-Parkinson-White in just a second, but this is a good time to slot this in. With investigations, of course, it's all about bedside, bloods and imaging. At the bedside, ECG and a full cardiovascular examination are the main things to do. For bloods, full blood count, ears and ears, and thyroid function are useful. Anemia can make a tachycardia worse because the circulatory system has to work harder to compensate for the lack of oxygen carrying ability. Electrolyte derangement is a common cause for arrhythmias in general, and could be relevant here. And undiagnosed hyperthyroidism can present with tachycardia and palpitations. In terms of imaging, an echocardiogram is often useful in older patients because SVT can be related to cardiovascular disease. It's a risk factor, as you said. Then I suppose, as a special test, if you've not been able to fully determine the SVT otherwise, further observation by giving a patient a type of ECG to wear for several days can be helpful. There are lots of different names for these, but one of these is called a Holter for reference.
So, to summarise so far, AVNRT and AVRT are cardiac impulse abnormalities which can cause paroxysmal SVT. Wolff-Parkinson-White is a type of AVRT with a pattern denoted by delta waves on ECG at rest. And then the possible investigations we might undertake for an SVT include an ECG, full blood count, EUSNEYS, thyroid function tests, echocardiogram, and possibly an ambulatory ECG as well.
Correct. There are so many acronyms in medicine, my God.
Yeah. So with all that in mind, how do we actually manage a supraventricular tachycardia?
Well, to be honest, we often don't have to because they just, you know, self-terminate, which is grand. However, when that hasn't happened, we follow an acute treatment algorithm. We construct this using our same structure of conservative, medical and surgical, although perhaps in this case, interventional might be a better phrase to use rather than surgical. Conservatively, we should try the least invasive treatment first, and that's vagal manoeuvres. So, we know the vagus nerve does lots of things. That includes being the parasympathetic branch to the heart. It therefore aims to promote rest and slow the heart rate. To do that, the vagus nerve can increase the braking effect of the AVN. As I said earlier, that can be enough to interrupt the re-entrance circuit leading to its termination. Carotid massage is a type of vagal maneuver, aka something that stimulates the vagus nerve. It's best to auscultate the carotid first in case there's a bruit, or avoid doing the maneuver entirely in patients with past history of stroke or TIA, because in theory, the massage could throw off a clot and it'd be very bad if there was an unstable plaque in the carotid, and we don't want to do that. It should also only be done unilaterally, as otherwise you'll risk cutting off the blood supply to the brain, which is bad. Another way forward would instead be to do a modified Valsalva, which doesn't involve the carotids, but requires more than one person to do a lot of the time. Fortunately, it also has a higher rate of termination, around 40%. I'll put a video link in the description actually for this, because if you're interested, it's a piece of advice that I think is actually really worth learning. It's a rather magic experience, I promise, being able to diagnose an arrhythmia, like an SVT, at silly o'clock in the morning on a night shift, and instantly be able to fix the patient with your bare hands.
Let's say we've tried a modified Valsalva and it hasn't worked. What would you do next?
Okay, this is where it starts to get more serious. You need to give a drug which can terminate the rhythm. So first line would be to recruit parasympathetic action via the vagus nerve, slowing the conduction velocity at the AV node. The drug in question is IV adenosine, and it's famous for making patients feel dreadful, a cause of which is actually kind of debated, but it might be due to other chemicals in the preparations for adenosine, we're not really sure. Anyway, the good news is the half-life is fractions of a second, so the dreadful effect is gone in less than a minute.
Okay, yeah, and I do seem to remember that it's a common warning that you will feel awful whilst adenosine is being given. You said the half-life is very short, though. Doesn't that mean it might not have enough time to work?
Yep, and it's one of the potential reasons IV adenosine might not work, is because it's all broken down before it even reaches the heart. That means good venous access close to the heart, for example, a wide-bore cannula in the ACF, is really what you need to give it a good chance to act. That being said, adenosine tends to work over 90% of the time, and you can give multiple rounds of it.
So what happens during the monitoring whilst adenosine is being given?
Well, you want continual monitoring during this to pick it up. The monitoring will show the SVT slowing and then suddenly terminating. That's as adenosine starts to take effect. It will hopefully demonstrate what the underlying slower rhythm was before terminating it. This is the critical moment where you can diagnose the underlying cause of the SVT, going from an umbrella term to an actual diagnosis. Then the output will restart, hopefully in normal sinus rhythm.
Are there any instances where you wouldn't give adenosine?
Yes, there are a few. And one issue is that adenosine is thought to cause bronchoconstriction, so it's often avoided in asthmatic patients. Second line treatment would be IV verapamil for reference.
So if the patient becomes hemodynamically unstable, say with a drop in cardiac output as we discussed earlier, or perhaps if the medical management fails, then what is the next step?
Well, hopefully the senior clinician leading this would then decide whether DC cardioversion could be used under some form of sedation or anaesthetic. This is also what's used in New AF for reference, by the way.
So in this scenario, let's say the second round of adenosine worked and the monitoring was reviewed by a cardiologist. They noted some slowing of the upstroke on the QRS complex when the rate was slowing, and then later confirmed a diagnosis of Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. What would we then do in the future once the acute situation has been managed?
So If there's a diagnosis of an accessory pathway, like the bundle of Kent, a cardiologist could try and ablate it, destroying it to stop it from conducting. That's your interventional definitive management.
Right, so that is supraventricular tachycardia from acute through to chronic management. Is there anything else you particularly wanted to cover?
No, I think that's all I wanted to cover today, actually. There is a lot of content here. I think we'll be fine.
Hi everyone, this is Sally and this is your quick summary on supraventricular tachycardias or SVTs. So SVT is an umbrella term that describes paroxysmal abrupt onset tachycardias. SVTs are common in all ages but are more commonly seen in women and the elderly. Symptoms include palpitations, diaphoresis, dyspnea and anxiety. On ECG you'll typically see a regular narrow complex tachycardia. The pathophysiology tends to be an abnormality of the myocardial conduction pathways or an accessory conduction pathway within the heart, which gives rise to reentrant loops of rapid cardiac depolarization. These are known as AV nodal and atrioventricular reentrant tachycardias. Episodes generally self-terminate without treatment. However, if not, and the patient is hemodynamically stable, management involves vagal maneuvers followed by IV adenosine. If the patient is unstable, DC cardioversion may be needed. Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome is caused by an accessory cardiac conduction pathway that can give rise to an AVRT and may present with pre-excitation delta waves on ECG. Wolff-Parkinson-White is a potential cause of sudden cardiac death, and the definitive treatment is radiofrequency ablation of the accessory pathway. Thanks for listening.